Okay, folks, we're going to kick things off again. So, I'm going to chair the next session. My name is Murray Smith. I teach in film aesthetics at the University of Kent. And it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker from Paris, Laure Lampenon, who is at the University of Paris Sorbonne. And she is the author. I'm going to give you the English title since I've already clearly established French is horrible. So we'll just go with the English title. So the translation would be The Question of Pictorial Realism, an Essay on Contemporary Theories of Iconic Representation. And Laure is also the translator of one of Dom Lopez's books, Understanding the Pictures. So without further ado, over to you, Laure. Welcome.
Thanks. So first I want to thank Endowment for his invitation. And I'm not able to improvise in English, so I sit here and I have text. I also want to say that I took this workshop as an opportunity to express my doubts, my questions, much more than to express a formal thesis. I will much more try to explain why it seems important to me to question such notions as indexicality, transparency, or belief-independent feature tracking, than to propose a new definition of the essence of the photographic picture. And please excuse my poor English and my French accent. I will focus today on the fact that history of color photography has been ignored by art historians and philosophers until a few years ago. And I will try to show that ignoring this is not mere coincidence, but has to do with the main thesis about photography as, among others, a purely causal process ensuring belief-independent feature tracking, or if we take André Bazin in France, that has been, or indexicality, Rosalind Krauss. I deliberately here do as if all these expressions were equivalent. I know also that the aim of this workshop is to investigate a new paradigm, since many of the speakers have already shown on other occasions on this morning why and how the old philosophy of photography could not do justice to much practices of photographic art. What I will propose today will maybe seen as a step backward, but the old philosophy is hard to supplant. It is hard to supplant because it seems so rational and full of common sense. And it seems to me that it is never vain to explain why people who are wrong believe they are right. My point today is to explain that the orthodox position is wrong partly because it has ignored color photography for too long. Therefore, I will distinguish three different paradigms of black and white photography, showing that a good paradigm for color photography is, as far as I know, still missing. But I know Dom Lopez is working on it, mostly with the lyric art form, I guess. And I hope that it will help fighting against wrong intuitions and judgments about photography. I can add that after what we've heard this morning, I don't know if my approach is philosophical or empirical, and I hope both of them. So, my title is Black and White versus Color, an issue for the philosophy of photography, and I will address this issue with the following outline. So I will start with the contradiction between black and white and color in Blow Up as an introductory example. Then I will come to the causal chain of photography and its links with the daguerreotype first and other kinds of techniques. In this part, I will deal with different versions of the belief-independent feature tracking thesis, and I will focus on the way they ignore color photography. And in my third part, I will underline the key events of the history of color photography, from the technical invention to the aesthetical legitimization. Finally, I'll try to conclude how to put it all together. So, as we are in London, let me start with the famous movie by Antonioni, Blow Up, shot in 1966, and keep this date in mind. 1966, it is 10 years before what we can call the legitimization of color photography by John Sarkovsky at the MoMA in 1976, when he presents the work of William Eggleston and writes a famous preface for the catalogue of this exhibition. But I don't want to anticipate too much. Why is Blow Up interesting regarding our questions? Because we can find in this movie a representation of two kinds of photography. Indeed, Thomas, played by David Hemmings here, is a photographer who practices two different kinds of photography. On the first side, it's the top pictures here, he's a professional photographer, more precisely a fashion photographer. And on the other side, he's an amateur photographer, the bottom pictures here, strolling along the streets in London, maybe aspiring to a more praised status, the status of artist or of street photographer, catching the decisive moment following Cartier-Bresson. What is important here is the fact that his professional practice is a practice of color photography, whereas his practice of amateur photography and or artistic photography is a practice of black and white photography. Moreover, we can say that in this movie, color photography is seen in the context of the 60s as a superficial, pointless practice with sexual connotations. By contrast, black and white is something one can take seriously. You can hear in this opposition the echoes of a very, very long story, starting with Plato's detraction of color as a cosmetic and deceit, and that further developed later with the opposition between drawing or engraving in black and white and painting in color. In Blow Up, it is a black and white photography which leads to knowledge, even if there is a doubt about its reliability. I will explain that later. And it has to do with Plato's critic of false knowledge and his praise of episteme. Black and white has to do with episteme, whereas color has to do with false knowledge, cosmetic and flattery. But there is more. If color photography refers here to the sociological background of the movie, you know that black and white has to do with the core of the plot. The way Antonioni introduces black and white photography in the screenplay comes close to a philosophical theory about the photographic picture. So this point has already been noticed by philosophers and art historians, and Blow Up is often mentioned in the theoretical text about photography. But I want to insist here on the fact that Antonioni didn't choose any property of photography. He chose some characteristics of photography, among others, by choosing black and white against color. And this choice has to do with the ignorance of color. I will emphasize in Bazin, Barthes, Walton, and Krauss, I will focus on in the next part. So, here are the characteristics of photography underlined by the scenes in the photo lab, when Thomas scrutinizes his pictures with a magnifying glass and enlarges them. The photographic picture is a picture which makes you see something invisible for the vision in normal conditions of perception. It is a very detailed picture, which you can enlarge many times until it is very grainy and you find a clue. The gun here, which will lead to the discovery of a dead body in the park. So it can play the role of evidence. Antonioni is more subtle and ambivalent than this brief summary. For example, after having found by night the dead body in the trees, thanks to the clue, the enlarged photograph, Thomas comes back to the park during the day and cannot find the body anymore, as if all the scene of the discovery of the dead body had been a dream. And there would be also much to say about the final scene, where the hero takes part into a real game of make-believe, as Kendall Walton defines it, picking up an invisible tennis ball, which mime artists have thrown over the tennis court. And the fence of the court is symbolizing, according to me, the conventional frame of representation. These two scenes, the one with the missing body and the final one with the invisible tennis ball, it is invisible but you can hear the sound of the ball being played, make the spectator doubt of what could be Antonioni's thesis about mimesis first and about photography secondly. So enough for blow up. What do we have come to this point? The antagonism between black and white and color, or episteme and cosmetic, which is mistakenly taken for granted. And the construction of a paradigm of the photographic picture, which is grounded on a selection of characteristics of a particular kind of photograph, characteristics which happen to be exactly those enhanced by Luis Arago in 1839 when he promoted the daguerreotypes technique. And I will tell more about this in a few minutes. What I will say is connected to what Dom said earlier this morning about the fact that philosophical theories were mostly built on what happened in the 40s. Last century. So, the causal chain of photography. Philosophically, the question arises immediately of the ontological specificity of photography, and indeed most art historians, philosophers, art critics, and artists seem to assume that photography is a special kind of picture, different from a drawing or painting. And even if they do not express this specificity with the same words, concepts, or arguments, they eventually agree about what we could refer to as the causal chain of photography or its automaticity. I will only give some example of these different approaches or traditions, taking for granted that they are well known, but they belong to the existing theories that can not only be corrected on the fringes. And I will only show how each of them is based on an idea of what a photograph is, that is itself based on the well-established history of photography as an history of black and white photography, starting with the invention of the daguerreotype and the calotypes. By the way, I have to say right away that a daguerreotype is not really a black and white picture, and that people had to wait until the expansion of the processing with gel silver bromide to get real photographs in black and white, showing a large panel of gray shades from dark black to light white. Therefore, technically speaking, black and white is an invention of the 20th century. Most of the monochromatic photographs of the 19th century showed, in fact, some colors due to many factors. For example, the blue reflections due to an overexposition of the daguerreotype, or the presence of Prussian blue in the cyanotype. And we have to keep in mind that black and white refers often more to an aesthetical quality than to a technical description. So I'll start with Bazin. I have chosen only very, very famous quotations. In the Ontology of the Photographic Image, it's 1958. The photographic image is the object itself, the object freed from the conditions of time and space that govern it, no matter how fuzzy, distorted, or discolored, no matter how lacking in documentary value the image may be, it shares, by virtue of the very process of its becoming, the being of the model of which it is the reproduction. It is the model. Hence, the charm of family albums. You can notice the last sentence here and think of the winter garden photograph of Bart's mother, the only picture the reader doesn't see in Camera Lucida. And what should never forget that Bazin and Bart are above all great defenders of amateur photography, of the family albums, and of an anthropological approach of photography. I underlined a few words in the quotation. Discolored, you see here, and the well-balanced construction of the sentence, no matter how, two times, no matter how, it is the model. And this construction reminds me of the famous discourse by Arago at the French Academy of Science on January the 7th in 1839, when he was championing Daguerre's patent. And I would like to show how nothing has changed between 1839 and 1958. What happened exactly in 1839, sorry. We can speak of the birth of a technique, but also of the birth of an idea, the idea of photographic picture. And one of the purpose of this workshop is to challenge this very old idea. I insist on the difference between the invention of a particular technique and the invention of an abstract idea. Maybe it is time to untie the link, don't know if it's the good word, to untie the link between these two inventions. Here is a quotation from Arago, so the first session on January the 7th. I don't translate everything, you have the translation in black. In Mr. Daguerre's pictures, as in a black pencil drawing, in a black manner engraving or aqua tinta, there is only white, black, and grey, only light, darkness, and half tones. The method creates drawings but not color paintings. Here, Arago uses the vocabulary of painters and art critics. You see half tones and so on. The lack of color is one of the reasons which explains that Arago has chosen to speak to scientists and not to artists first. You have to wait until August to see members of the Beaux-Arts Academy attending to a session where Daguerre at least revealed the use of the daguerreotype. And by the way, the public displays will wait until September. So the parallel between daguerreotype and drawing has been made. As soon as the invention of this technique has been disclosed, but before the technique was precisely explained, both on the optical level and on the chemical level. But right from the start, the lack of color has been balanced by the accuracy of the daguerreotype. And all the people, mostly journalists and scientists, who have championed the Daguerre's invention have underlined the difference between this accuracy and the pictures printed on paper, like the salted paper prints made by Henry Fox Talbot from calotype, the calotype being itself a negative on paper. Don't mix them. So, the first photogenic drawings were performed in 1835. Indeed, the prints on papers showed more irregularities, more fuzziness than the daguerreotype. And here we find again the opposition between drawing and painting. The invention of the idea of photography is also based on the commercial strategy of Daguerre and Arago, because Daguerre was confronted to various people claiming authorship for their invention, for the invention of the first photographic image. The two more dangerous rivals, it is well known, were Henry Fox Talbot and, in France, Hippolyte Bayard. Talbot claimed anteriority for his calotypes in January the 29th, arguing that, first, his pictures were due to the registration of an image in the camera oscura, and, second, that they are fixing on a paper. And Hippolyte Bayard invented a process of direct positive printing on paper. So, I guess you see what is at stake here. Daguerre had to prove the preeminence of the silver plate on the paper prints. Hence, the insistence on two words in all the articles you can read in the press of 1839. First, the mirror, and second, the magnifying glass. The magnifying glass you have in blow-up. Those who compare the daguerreotype to the reflected image in the mirror were in line with Plato, again, in the Book 10 of the Republic, when Socrates declares, having both the painter and the sophist in focus, that there is a maker, it's a quotation, we don't have it, but there is a maker of the works of all workmen who makes not only vessels, but plants and animals, himself, the earth and heaven, and things in heaven and under the earth, first and second, and that this making is a very simple operation, since you have only to take a mirror and catch the reflection of the sun and the earth and anything else there. Now you have made them. It is a way to refuse image any materiality, focusing only on its representational dimension. It is as if a picture were only a representation of something without being itself also a real thing. To support this thesis, you have to ignore the presence of pigments in the case of painting and of a chemical process in the case of photography. If the journalists of that time were inclined to compare the daguerreotype to the image in the mirror, it is also because Arago did not deliver a proper scientific explanation of the physico-chemical process. He only described the machine and its optical properties. Description versus explanation, you find here a reason for the comparison with a magical phenomenon, Acheiro Poieta, made without hand. Furthermore, the magnifying glass has a precise role to play in this context of competition between Daguerre and Talbot or Bayard. I said that Daguerre had to prove the preeminence of the silver plate on the paper prints. To this aim, the magnifying glass is really of great help. It's my translation here in black. It's extracted from an article in the Gazette de France, still in January. So, colors are not reproduced, but the accuracy is beyond all one can imagine. Look carefully at these drawings through a magnifying glass, and you will see that details lose none of their astonishing sharpness. When Arago made his famous speech at the French Academy of Sciences, he did not bring any picture with him. I've already told that. And I've already said that the first public display was performed in September. But Daguerre had many visitors, and if you read the press articles of those months, you will notice that those who had the opportunity of visiting Daguerre's studio often mentioned the magnifying glass as an instrument Daguerre gave to his visitors in order to show them how accurate his pictures were, and how you could discover new details in the pictures by scrutinizing it and without ever seeing the materiality of the surface. Whereas by moving forward, you can always see the marks and shadings on the surface of a painting, a drawing, or an engraving. You cannot discover the marks on a daguerreotype, even by looking through a magnifying glass. Here are some quotations extracted from newspapers. I've brought three quotations, but there is really a lot of quotations I could have bring with me. So, I have only translated the beginning. All this is wonderful, but let's say, what ensures, what tells us that this is not the work of a skillful draughtsman? How are we sure that you are not showing us bistre or sepia watercolors? As an answer, Mr. Daguerre gives us a magnifying glass. Second one, so details that cannot be seen with the naked eye but are very distinctly seen through a magnifying glass. The last one, it's a beautiful sentence in French but only translated the beginning. The fearful magnifying glass, the devastating magnifying glass that unveils abominations even in the finest, in the lightest, I didn't know how to translate aérien in English, so, of our masterpieces can wander in vain on these products of art. So, the lack of color has turned into a positive quality. Accuracy and sharpness are the qualities enhanced by those who praise Daguerre's invention. After the example of blow-up and after my digression on Arago and Daguerre, you can see that we have to deal with different paradigms of the photographic pictures, which coexist and are sometimes in competition. The opposition between black and white and color, so serious futile, and the opposition between daguerreotype and calotype, or paper prints, Talbot Bayard, accuracy versus fuzziness. What I will say on Bart is linked to the first opposition, and what I will say on Kendall Walton is linked to the second one. And for the moment, I did not find a place for "it is the model" yet, from the quotation from Bazin. So, let me focus on Bart. Maybe I will, switch to the second. So, I will focus on the chapter 34, in which Bart confesses his reluctance to or disregard for color photography. Perhaps it is because I am delighted or depressed. So remember here the context of the book. Bart's mother died a few months before. To know that the thing of the past, by its immediate radiations, its luminances, has really touched the surface, which in its turn my gaze will touch, that I am not very fond of color. An anonymous daguerreotype of 1843 shows a man and a woman in a medallion subsequently tinted by the miniaturist on the staff of the photographic studio. I have always feel unimportant what actually occurs, that in the same way, color is a coating applied later on to the original truth of the black and white photograph. For me, color is an artifice, a cosmetic, like the kind used to paint corpses. What matters to me is not the photograph's life, a purely ideological notion, but the certainty that the photograph body touches me with its own rays and not with a super added light. Hence, the Winter Garden photograph, however pale, is for me the treasury of rays which emanated from my mother as a child, from her hair, her skin, her dress, her gaze, on that day. So when you read here, however pale, recall, no matter how discolored, the words of André Bazin 20 years before. So we can underline two different points concerning black and white photography here. With Bart, we have to do with a slightly different paradigm of black and white photography. This is not as much a detailed picture as a magical one. It is to be compared with "It is the model" from Bazin, a sentence which is quoted by Rosalind Krauss in Notes on the Index, and also to the natural counterfactual dependency. It is what Barthes calls the certificate of presence here. I just read the two quotations. What the photograph reproduces to infinity has occurred only once. Photograph mechanically repeats what could never be repeated existentially. And every photograph is a certificate of presence. The certificate is the new gene which its invention has introduced into the family of images. And the second point here is the reluctance to color. We are in 1980, and I understand his reluctance to color as a reluctance to something superficial, something by which one can be distracted from what is really important, namely the anthropological meaning of photography, what he romantically calls the sufferings or the pangs of love. At that time, color photography was still associated with fashion and advertising above all. I can also mention Walton. The notion of transparency was, it is well known, but I need to say that first. It was first used by Greenberg to tell the difference between painting and photography which allowed to be... which was allowed to be naturalistic in virtue of this transparency, and photography could not be modernist, and it does not have to, because its transparency prevents it from any reflexivity on its medium, etc., on the conventions which govern its production. So, the concept of transparency is applied by Walton to photography and understood as counterfactual dependence on the subject. Among the most quoted sentences of the article of 1984, I have chosen the three following ones. So, the invention of the camera gave us not just a new method of making pictures and not just pictures of a new kind, it gave us a new way of seeing. Walton describes, we know that, photography as a process that gives us access to what is distant in space and time. Second, photographs are transparent. We see the world through them. My claim is that we see quite literally our dead relatives themselves when we look at photographs of them. The second quotation is often compared to the beginning of Camera Lucida, when Barthes writes, looking at a photograph of Napoleon's youngest brother, I am looking at the eyes that looked at the emperor. Sometimes I would mention this amazement, but since no one seemed to share it, nor even to understand it, life consists of these little touches of solitude, I forgot about it. And in the third quotation, one can read the difference between, so to be transparent is not necessarily to be invisible. The difference here between Roger Scruton's conception of transparency, which is not compatible with seeing the medium, the photo itself, and the more refined conception of transparency pioneered by Walton. It is also a way to criticize Greenberg's statement about photography's incapacity to be modernist. It is well known that Walton explains the difference between paintings and photographs by a difference in how we acquire information from pictures of the two kinds. It is also well known that his argument is based on the natural counterfactual dependence of photographs on what they are photographs of, and that this natural counterfactual dependency enables one to distinguish between photography and drawing. What is interesting for me here is specifically the choice made by Walton to switch from painting to sketches and drawings as he starts to explain the difference between painting and photography. So, drawing and sketches are not painting. And furthermore, the example of the explorer who can use a camera or a pencil to capture the image of the famous dinosaur. I won't recall the whole argument. but the fact that the painter is here a draughtsman, besides a scientist and not an artist, is interesting because it is related to the construction of the abstract idea of photography in the 19th century. Already in 1839, the journalists realized right away the great benefits that the draughtsman would have gained from photography during the Napoleon Bonaparte's Egypt campaign 40 years before. And Arago himself mentioned the archaeologists as being one of the first professions being concerned by the invention. So comparing photographs to drawings, Walton is following a very old conception of photography as a rival of drawing, devoted to scientists and not to artists, an idea of photography that which has been built in 1839. So at this stage, we still have the opposition between black and white and color, serious futile, illustrated by Blow Up and by chapter 34, and the opposition between daguerreotype and calotype, paper prints, so between accuracy and details fuzziness. It is what I will call the first paradigm of black and white photography. But we find also a new dimension of the black and white paradigm related to the role of evidence played by the enlarged photographs in Blow Up, underlined by Barthes with his That Has Been, by Bazin with It Is the Model, and which can be expressed in Walton terms, I mean the natural counterfactual dependency. And it is the second paradigm of black and white photography. My last example will be Rosalind Krauss, because we will find in her text the second paradigm again, but also a third one related to calotype. Related to calotype, so related to the calotype we mentioned in the first paradigm as a rival of the daguerreotype, I have chosen two articles, so Notes on the Index, 1977, and Impressionism, the Narcissism of Light, 3 years before, 1974. The purpose of Notes on the Index is to show that it is Marcel Duchamp who first connected index as a special kind of sign with photography. Indexicality is used by Rosalind Krauss in a particular context to defend minimalist sculpture, partly against Michael Fried. I'm interested here in the use of Man Ray as mediation between Duchamp and photography because Rosalind Krauss, as an art historian, is well informed about the practices and introduces another kind of black and white picture than the daguerreotype. Here is the paragraph about Man Ray and his photograms. Man Ray intersects with Duchamp's career not only in this document for the large glass, but in those other photographic occasions of Duchamp's work in the production of the film Anemic Cinema and in the transvestite portraits of Duchamp Rose C'est la Vie, which is interesting because Man Ray is the inventor of the rheograph, that subspecies of photo, which forces the issue of photography's existence as the index. Rheographs, or as they are more generally termed, photograms, are produced by placing, etc., etc. So, and photogram is seen as a subspecies of photography in general. But the photogram only forces and makes explicit what is the case of all photography. Every photograph is the result of a physical imprint transferred by light reflections onto a sensitive surface. The photograph is thus a type of icon of visual likeness which bears an indexical relationship to its object. So, stop here. And follows a quotation from André Bazin I have read a few minutes ago. No matter how fuzzy, distorted, or discolored the image may be, it is the model. I know that Rosalind Krauss uses this notion of index borrowed from Peirce to build the concept of what we call le photographique in French. I don't know in English how to translate this term. An artistic paradigm she can export in other fields as photography. For example, in his analysis of minimalist sculptures. Indexicality enables Rosenkranz to escape the ontological quest of the medium specificity and the domination of the modernist pattern. But, look, I know all that, but what I'm interested in is the fact that she deals here with another kind of black and white picture than the daguerreotype. Both daguerreotypes and photograms are monochromatic pictures. But whereas the daguerreotype mostly refers to a very detailed and accurate picture, the photogram mostly refers to the what she calls the absoluteness of the physical genesis. Hence, the Bazin's quotation, the quotation from Bazin at the end of the paragraphs of notes on the index I have read. It is the model, or that has been Barthes. Bazin, Barthes, and Krauss all enhance the second kind of property. But 3 years before Notes on the Index, she wrote an article which is far less quoted, but which is important for us. It is Impressionism, the Narcissism of Light. This article deals with a paradox inherent to Impressionism, which Krauss expresses in the following way. Yet the discussions of Impressionism always bog down in what appear to be the internal contradictions of the style. Because with Impressionism, gregariousness contains the seeds of a growing introversion. The heightened sense of formal artifice diverting one's attention from the outer world to the inner processes of its depiction. Zola, quick to champion the Impressionists, was as quick to back away once the style came into its own. Where he had earlier seen the promise of a developing naturalism, he began to observe a growing sketchiness which had developed to the point where the subjects of pictures were betrayed by the fractured crust of color that seemed to overlay them. After that, wondering why pictorial illusion broke down into a display of the picture's physical parts, so deposits of pigment, track marks of the brush, etc., Krauss suggests to start with Daubigny, Monet, and Degas instead of Manet, so as did Michael Fried. And what is interesting for us is that she defends this assumption by referring to the influence of photography on those painters, but not any kind of photography. She's not interested in the paradigm of the detailed black and white photograph coming from the daguerreotype, the first one I bring out, because she's not first interested in the details, but in masses of light and dark, which can be seen as stylistic features relevant for a good description, both of Daubigny's and Monet's painting. We think of Impressionism as an art of color, she says, but it did not start that way. Before 1874, Monet is a tonal painter, structuring landscape through the procedures of black and white contrast. I show you some. Here are some pictures from Daubigny. See, for example, Daubigny. I quote Rosalind Krauss. At that point, the story gets more interesting because, unlike Boudin, Eugène Boudin, or indeed the other members of the Barbizon school, Daubigny was a real open-air painter. This is to say that he was out there in the fields, not simply making sketches, which he then took back to the studio where the real painting would be constructed. Instead, he was standing his ground and insisting that the thing he made out of doors was the painting. And this, despite the fact that the thing he made in that condition was quite peculiar. It was an image that was extremely polarized in terms of broad masses of light and dark. And within those masses, there was precious little in the way of articulation. It was as though both the modulation of the form, shading, and the presence of detail, drawing, had been gobbled up at the opposite ends of the light spectrum. Everything darker than medium was summarized with featureless lumps of near black, and everything lighter was left as a creamy field. At this point, you have the quotation here, and the three last lines. At this point, one wants to ask the question, what was there in Daubigny's experience that prevented him from translating nature into paintings that were conventionally unified? The answer that seems to recapture the logic of the situation is photography. I have underlined the thing he made in that condition was quite peculiar because it suggests that often it is in order to understand what we are really looking at when we are looking at a picture that we need to draw parallels between different mediums. And it has to do with some questions about Costello's talk this morning. Krauss introduces what I will call a third paradigm of black and white photography. The model is not daguerreotype anymore, but calotype. Here, the black and white picture is not showing a large spectrum of gray shades and a lot of details, but it is a well-balanced composition in terms of light exposure, darkness and light. The paving stones and the humidity that registered on the daguerreotype plate in the astonishing way that they brought the distance into focus were evidence of the meagerness of human vision. And in a completely opposite way, Talbot's calotype, which generated the image from a negative, called in evidence about the meagerness of a different sort. We might call it evidence about the need for human vision to fill in the details of a nature polarized into the absolutes of dark and light. The calotype involved a different process from the daguerreotype and resulted in a different image. Producing prints from an oil paper negative, the calotype's images were not as finely resolved as those of the unique glass daguerreotype. They were composed of more abrupt masses of black and white. They were blunt and strange, nearly without detail. The calotypes we have from the 50s bear a striking resemblance to the pictures by Daubigny. So, akin to calotype is another kind of picture, which is not a photograph, but an etching monotype. Monotypes are impressions pulled from drawings made in painter's ink on metal or glass plates. And there are two techniques, the dark field manner you have here or the light field manner, depending on the fact you remove ink or you draw directly with ink. Krauss explains how monotype play the same role for Degas as calotype for Daubigny and Monet. The grainy aspect of calotype, contrary to daguerreotype, is what allows the comparison between calotype and monotype. There is something else the calotype contained which is worth noting. Unlike the daguerreotype, its images had grain. The calotype print displayed the fibrous texture of the paper negative from which it was made. Nature might have folded back upon herself, but first she had to touch ground upon a man-made object. In that tension between the disunity of the lights and darks of the image and the repetitions of the granular structure of the paper are the seeds of a whole new conception of unity. So, we can make a difference here between two kinds of black, depending on whether you speak of daguerreotype or of calotype and monotype. In the case of daguerreotype, it would be more correct to speak of gray shades and of a monochromatic picture. Whereas in the case of monotype, we could say that black is a color and that it makes sense to speak of black and white. So the parallel between callotype and monotype is based on the grainy aspect of both techniques and on the polarization into black and white shapes. And I am not sure that callotypes, so I'm not sure then that callotypes, when compared to monotypes, belong to the black and white category insofar as it is opposed to color. I would even say that if one follows Krauss' demonstration, callotypes, however monochromatic or black and white they're in black and white they are, belong to the category of color photography in virtue of their fuzziness, grainy aspect, and lack of details. Putting it like this, black and white and color are much more aesthetical values than essential properties of pictures. And it is also a way to make the blurring of boundaries between painting and photography plausible. If I want to explain this last assumption, I have to insist on the last point developed by Rosalind Krauss about the invention of the photometer by Arago. A photometer, I don't know if I pronounce it well, so you have the word here, photometer, is an instrument that measures light intensity. And I quote Impressionism, the narcissism of light. A year after the first photograph was made, Arago invented the photometer, a primitive light meter that brought with it unsettling information. If pointed at a patch of white paint and then at a patch of black paint, so only painting, the photometer would register the difference on its scale of 1 for black to 90 for white. But if aimed at the lightest part of the sky and then down at the darkest shadow on the ground, the instrument would record a separation of 1 to 9,000. The inferences that had to be drawn from this are fairly clear. The range of the natural array was simply off the scale of human vision and demonstrably beyond the reach of the constricted power of art to record it. That artificial unity of the painting, in terms of its neat circle of values, up toward white from its bistre brown or down toward black, was shown to be the most hopeless kind of contrivance. For nature stood revealed as polarized, split apart, distended, beyond the grasp of an artist's means. I'm always thinking about... the first time I came to New York, trying to only to take pictures of the buildings in New York, and having to deal with the big contrast of sky and street. And when, as in the callotype, nature presented herself to herself, she did so in terms of a near unintelligibility, unintelligibility. It has to do with the picture of the callotype I show you first. The shadowy flatness of the callotype presenting nature pushing toward the limits of the light spectrum, folded back upon herself in a supreme lack of definition. We could then call photographical any kind of picture which still shows something of this polarization, whereas we could consider every picture showing a unified composition without a too much large gap between light and darkness and correcting the extreme polarization of nature as a painting. Hence, this judgment Rosalind Krauss expresses on Degas. I show you the Cotton Exchange from 1873. And pastels, I didn't mention the fact that Degas, it's really important, did a lot of pastels by marking the second print of monotype. The monotype, there was one or two prints. And on the second print, he added a pastel. So, until the monotype gave Degas a way of really absorbing the message of photography, he was not an impressionist. Before the mid-70s, he was an inspired naturalist painter, she says. And here you have the quotation, but it is not an impressionist one. In the Cotton Exchange, texture is seamlessly integrated to a sense of underlying mass, and the space could have been laid out by Euclid. Only after the monotypes does one feel Degas consistently forcing a separation, a rift between the masses of bodies and the particles that stand for the optical recording of their textures. It is as if the eye, looking at the figures, could only catch their surfaces because the figures themselves were looking the other way. And this leads to my last part, the history of color photography. You have here a very brief history of color photography focused on both on the technical invention and on the aesthetical legitimization. 1839, the invention of daguerreotype and discourse of Arago at the Academy of Science in Paris, so accuracy, details, the competition with drawing, lack of color. 1848, the first photograph of the solar spectrum here by Edmond Becquerel. It's a metal plate sensitized, I don't know, with silver chloride, and it's a directly positive image. I mention it here because I am currently participating to a research program called Photochroma with a physicist in the Museum of Natural History in Paris. And the physicists of this program try to understand the possible link with the Lippmann interference method. You have a lot of stages between 1848 and 1893. Louis Ducos-Duron, Charles Cros, Gabriel Lippmann, etc. And finally, 93 and 97, invention and commercialization of autochrome by Auguste and Louis Lumière. Here are some autochromes. ...1936, commercialization of Kodachrome and Neuagfa color, mostly used in fashion, advertising, and progressively in amateur photography. And finally, 1976, William Eggleston has a solo exhibition of color prints at the MoMA, and it is the moment of the aesthetical legitimization of color. So I show you some pictures, the solar spectrum, autochromes, Eggleston, and Walker Evans, so the famous work in the subway or in Let's Now Praise a Famous Man, and the Polaroids of the 70s. To illustrate the turning point of 1976, we have this famous case of Walker Evans. First declaring in 1969, color tends to corrupt photography, and absolute color corrupts it absolutely. Consider the way color film usually renders blue sky, green foliage, lipstick red, and the kiddies' play suit. There are four simple words for the matter, which must be whispered. Color photography is vulgar. And then buying a Polaroid SX-70 4 years later and declaring in 1974, a year ago, I would have said that color is vulgar and should never be tried under any circumstances. It is a paradox that I'm now associated with it, and in fact, I intend to come out with it seriously. Don't laugh, it's very serious and important to me. So it has to do with my conclusion. Don't laugh. So the case of Walker Evans, his turnaround is emblematic of the turning point of the 70s and has surely had an influence on the choice made by John Sarkovsky to display William Eggleston's color prints at the MoMA in 1976, because Eggleston's style was somehow akin to the documentary tradition, And if the most famous photographer of this tradition, Walker Evans, has moved to color, color could become something serious. Let me end by making two remarks. The first one concerns the whole history of photography. There are at least two gaps important for us. The first one is the interval between 1848 and 97, namely between almost 50 years, namely between the technical invention of black and white or monochromatic photography and of color photography. During this interval, what I have called, following François Brunet in France, the idea of photography, had plenty of time to grow on the basis of the three paradigms of black and white photography I have tried to identify. The second one is the interval between 97 and 1976, namely between the technical invention of color photography and its aesthetical legitimization. Here, it is the prejudice against color as cosmetic which had time to settle. As a conclusion, I will read, and I'm already finished, can I take 3 minutes? I will read a few paragraphs extracted from Sarkovsky's preface to William Eggleston Guy. Gifted photographers, learning from the successes of their predecessors, he's talking about black and white photography, quickly acquire the ability to recognize and anticipate certain aspects of subject matter, situation, perspective, and quality of light that might produce effective pictures. So not like me the first time I came to New York. Original photographers enlarge this shared sense of possibilities by discovering new patterns of fact that will serve as metaphors for their intention. I am not sure I can explain my intuition rigorously here, but according to me, in my view, this quotation from Tarkovsky can be related to the invention of the photometer Rosalind Krauss mentioned in order to explain how it gave us access to a new form of perception which calotypes and monotypes illustrated perfectly well. Photographers had to learn how to balance and evenly distribute masses of light and dark. Hence, once again, the recurrent pattern of shadow in the history of black and white photography. I'm thinking of Kertész. I carry on my reading of Tarkovsky. Imagine then, after the photographer had spent a century learning how to use his medium in monochrome, what chaos resulted when he was suddenly presented with a cheap and virtually foolproof color film. The technical geniuses who developed this wonderful advance assumed naturally that more was better, and that the old pictures plus color could only be more natural. Only three more quotations and I'm done. For the photographer who demanded formal rigor from his pictures, color was an enormous complication of a problem already cruelly difficult. And I jump straight to the end of the quotation. Professionals used color when they were paid to, doing their very best. So remember Cartier-Bresson, who has always presented his practice of color photography as a compromise. Without quite knowing what they meant by that. Considering the lack of enthusiasm and confidence with which most ambitious photographers have regarded color, it is not surprising that most work in the medium has been puerile. Most color photography, in short, has been either formless or pretty. In the first case, the meanings of color have been ignored. In the second, they have been considered at the expense of elusive meanings. While editing directly from life, photographers have found it too difficult to see simultaneously both the blue and the sky. And my last quotation. In the past decade, a number of photographers have begun to work in color in a more confident, more natural, and yet more ambitious spirit, working not as though color were a separate issue. a problem to be solved in isolation. Isolation. Not thinking of color as photographers 70 years ago thought of composition, but rather as though the world itself existed in color, as though the blue and the sky were one thing. I jump to these pictures are not photographs of color, and any more than they are photographs of shapes, textures, objects, symbols, or events, but rather photographs of experience. And it has been ordered and clarified within the structures imposed by the camera. In a summary, a new philosophy of photography should be able to explain why color photographs are not only photographs of color, meaning photographs as defined in a black and white paradigm of photography. The first one, the second one, or the third one, you can choose the one you want. So meaning photographs defined in a black and white paradigm of photography, as defined in a black and white paradigm of photography, that happen to capture subjects which are colored. Color photography is something else, and invites us to find a paradigm different from the three black and white paradigms I have mentioned. So, and I think what I said here has to do with the first distinction from Darmod between to be about color, not just of color. So to conclude, I tried to show that color photography has been overlooked, and I have distinguished three different paradigms of black and white photography, showing first that those paradigms were all dependent on a particular technique, hence their incapacity to do justice to much practices of photographic art. And second, that a good paradigm for color photography is, as far as I know, still missing. And I propose to consider Zarkovsky's words with a renewed attention. What does it mean to make a distinction between photographs of color and color photographs? It sounds like a research program. Color is not just something you add to a black and white photograph, not just a coating applied later on the truth of the black and white photographs, as Barthes would say. And asking this question is a way to include photography in the more general category of pictures which convey information by articulating a material dimension, the medium, to a representational one, whatever the nature of the picture, figurative or abstract. So, thank you for your attention.